on this week's program, as the Philadelphia Orchestra opens its latest season, we speak with music director Christoph Eschenbach. Susan Lewis takes us down to the River of Gold, a new exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. The show displays pre-Columbian gold artifacts from a 1940 excavation of a cemetery in Panama, which was covered for centuries until the river changed course. And Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at the job of the playwright. We'll hear from Philadelphia writers Thomas Gibbons, Bruce Graham, and Michael Hollinger. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra opens its new season this week with a series of concerts featuring Tchaikovsky's First Symphony and Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. These performances open a season the orchestra is advertising as a really big season with monumental works, and there's at least some truth in the hype. The coming months will see the ensemble performing a variety of grand pieces, including Mahler's Symphony of a Thousand, Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, Richard Strauss's Alpine Symphony, Janáček's Sinfonietta, and Revuelta's underperformed epic Night of the Mayas. The season also features a Leonard Bernstein festival in honor of what would have been his 90th year. I met with orchestra music director Christoph Eschenbach earlier this week at the Kimmel Center to discuss the orchestra's new season. As you walk down Broad Street these days, there are signs hanging from the streetlights proclaiming this a monumental season, a huge season. When did it occur to you that it would be monumental, or was that something that was pointed out to you after the fact?
It was pointed to me after the fact, because I just, you know, for example, things came by chance. I wanted to have a Russian program, so I did the Sacre du Printemps, the Rite of Spring, which is a monumental work. And the Mahler 8 was due this season, indeed a monumental work. And then we wanted to do something for Leonard Bernstein's 90th birthday. And we do a kind of a Bernstein festival, which is also not monumental works which we perform, but it's a monumental composer and personality. Yeah, so it came together like this. And also, I wanted to do a piece which I wanted to do from beginning on here, that is Schubert 9th, is also the big one, the great or the grand or how you call it. And so it came together like this a bit.
Talk to me about your relationship with Bernstein as you were evolving as a musician yourself, because I think people on this side of the Atlantic are not as aware as they might be of just how influential Bernstein was, not only in this country, but around the world.
Absolutely. And also to me. I mean, I got to know him when my piano playing already declined, so to say, at least in numbers of performances and numbers of conductors I played with. And then I stopped playing with conductors and doing recitals. But I got to know him and his family. I'm very, very close to his son and his daughters still, and was very close to his wife, who was absolutely, absolutely wonderful person. And I was very often invited with them in New York, first in Park Avenue, then in the Dakota, sometimes alone, sometimes with his family, visited me in my house in Gran Canaria, and never forget these endless nights. I mean, for him, not endless, but for me, endless. Where he played just for 3 hours Vienna waltzes and sang and was absolutely a fountain of energy, and also very funny things that I played once with Boulez in the New York Philharmonic, and we were both invited at the Bernsteins, and somehow he didn't like very much Boulez. As a person, yes, but not as a composer, I guess. And so he said, oh, let's play the Mozart double sonata for him. It's in D major. So he sat down on these two pianos, and I played the first part, and he played the second part, but he played it in C-sharp major. It sounded just horrible. And so that was his biting wit he had offered.
You've commissioned several works for this season, and in connection with the Bernstein Festival by our own adopted Jennifer Higdon. Why did Jennifer Higdon suggest herself for a tribute to Bernstein?
I think, you know, her way of writing, which touches, and especially in one of these pieces, the written for the Time for Three trio, it touches a bit popular music, as did Bernstein's West Side Story, which became a classic, of course, but or his Candide. And I think in this way, she fits very well into the picture, and I'm sure that he would have loved her.
I want to talk about the Mahler Symphony No. 8. It's the end of your five-year Mahler cycle. Tell me about the planning for something like a Symphony No. 8, because it's not something one takes on lightly.
No, because it's very difficult to cast, and it's very expensive, let's face it. And it has two big choruses and a big children chorus and large orchestra and eight soloists. And it's really a nightmare for a presenter and a delight for a performer.
And for a conductor, though. That's a lot of people to manage in one performance.
Yeah, in fact, yes.
Is it something you enjoy, that level of music making?
Sure. I have done the Mahler 8 rather often, and it was always the great moment of the year, so to say. In fact, I do it next year, Sweet Time.
Final question. I want to ask you about the opening programs. The First Symphony of Tchaikovsky and The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky. Why did you pair these two works together?
Because the First Symphony, Tchaikovsky, deals very much with Russian folk tunes, as does The Rite of Spring. And it's much more Russian folk tune based than the other Tchaikovsky symphonies. And also, I love the symphony particularly. It's a very pure and very very powerful statement.
We'll be right back. An excerpt from Thursday evening's season-opening performance of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. The Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by music director Christoph Eschenbach, recorded live at Verizon Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Gold is a timeless treasure, craved by civilizations throughout recorded history. Shiny and brilliant, malleable and strong, linked to the gods themselves, gold has long been known to be one of Earth's few indestructible elements. Its luster and its immortality has lent it a spiritual significance in many cultures, while in modern society its allure continues. An exhibition at Penn's University Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology displays artifacts from a Panamanian civilization that existed around 700 AD, evidence of which was revealed only in the 20th century. River of Gold tells the story not only of this ancient civilization, but of the work involved in bringing its discovery to light in 1940. WRTI's Susan Lewis has more.
It's easy to picture children playing along a tropical riverbank, some running, some squatting and digging with sticks in the sloping dirt and grasses that grow at the side of the water. With the sun blazing overhead, what look like small stones at their feet glint and glimmer, begging to be picked up and played with, demanding to be discovered. This was how the story started about the River of Gold, or the Rio Grande de Clocle, a mountain river that runs from the Sierra across the coastal plains of Panama, emptying into the Bay of Parida.
That particular river, back in the early 1900s, overflowed its banks, cut a new course for itself, and in so doing exposed a major burial of one of these ancient Panamanian chiefs.
Pamela Jardine is curator of the University of Pennsylvania Museum's River of Gold exhibition. When we enter the gallery, the deep purplish walls contain us, cave-like. As we look across the darkened, windowless space, focused beams of light glow from above or below onto small groups of gleaming treasures laid out in glass cases by exhibit designer Jack Murray.
I wanted to provide something that was intimate, and yet I wanted the gold and the pottery as well to sparkle.
Most of the objects are gold, intricate cast pendants of composite animals, hammered breastplates, armbands, necklaces, ear rods, and nose rings. There is also pottery, some whole vessels, as well as bowls that have been put together from pieces. The exhibition tells several stories. One, of an ancient civilization, the existence of which was missed for centuries, overlooked by explorers, even the 16th century Spanish conquerors, who knew, more or less, what they were looking for.
The Spaniards knew that these Indians buried their powerful chiefs with all their gold on their chests when they died. So they had very systematically looked for these giant burials. But this one had been overlooked because it's in a pasture that's now a cattle field. And there are no markers. There's nothing to indicate that there was a cemetery there.
Another story is of the river that finally washed over and exposed the treasures. First came the tiny gold beads. Then larger objects began to appear.
Some of the gold pendants and things. And so those pieces were sold in the art market, and they ended up in Panama City. And the Panamanian exposition was there in 1915, which was when the Panama Canal opened, and word got out to the archaeologists in the United States.
The cattle field alongside the river, about 100 miles west of Panama City, became known as Sitio Conte, because by the early 20th century, the Conte family owned the land and the mineral rights beneath it. Harvard University excavated in the 1930s, then recommended the University of Pennsylvania for further exploration. In 1940, archaeologist J. Alden Mason put together a crew to see what they could find in the three-month period before the rainy season. They struck gold, literally, in a spot designated as Burial 11. Now a retired Foreign Service officer, Mason's then 17-year-old son was on the dig. John Mason remembers that his father, concerned about security with so much gold lying around, came up with a solution. He asked John to go and sleep in the large grave that was being excavated.
My dad said, "So what I'd like you to do, Johnny, would be to get your cot and take it down and set it up in the pit beside the gold and just spend the night there so we have somebody there to keep an eye on it." So I, when it was sleepy time, went down and stretched out on the cot, and it was a lovely night. I remember it as a full moon, but my memory may gild it a little bit. guild is a good term here, because the moon was shining down brilliantly on this mass of gold. To see that whole glittering mass in the moonlight was indeed quite a moment, and I've never forgotten it.
With all this gold, the Conti family had the same deal with Penn as it had had with Harvard. Penn could take what it collected back home, provided it paid the family half the value, and turned over any duplicate objects found. Penn returned to Philadelphia with thousands of objects, a number of which have been displayed over the years. Handling gold safely might not seem like a problem, but Penn Museum's conservator for loans and traveling exhibits, Lynn Grant, says that looks can be deceiving.
This material is actually a gold alloy that's been treated to make the surface gold rich. And the same treatment that they did to do this, which was very sophisticated given the level of culture, makes it very brittle. So normally with some of these big plaques that we have, if you place stress on it and it was pure gold, it would just crumple like a piece of paper. These ones, if you put that kind of stress on them, they'd be more likely to crunch like a potato chip.
The sophistication of the creation of a gold alloy, the intricate gold-making techniques, and the sheer amount of gold worn by the leader tells us how the culture valued this precious metal, still revered today, says curator Pamela Jardine.
And how these chiefs, when they wore it, that actually was taking them into a position of supernatural authority as well as political authority on earth. They were tied to gold and the sun and celestial power and supernatural power. That's some people's theory as to why they were bedecked in gold.
Much of what was known about these pre-Columbian people came from the accounts of the 16th century Spaniards, who wrote of the mass burials of village chiefs and their wives and servants, who were killed to accompany the chiefs into the afterlife. The Penn excavation, done scientifically, meticulously recorded the location of every find. This exhibition lays out the objects from Burial 11 in the order in which they were discovered. Exhibit designer Jack Murray says there were three layers of graves, each with its own status.
The first case will be from level one, and then the next group of cases is from the middle burial, which was the richest burial with the number of individuals in that grave, and then the third burial, which was at the bottom of the pit that they dug, was apparently just chuck-filled with all this pottery.
Most of the pottery was in pieces, believed to be ceremonially broken to line the walls of the grave. A few have been reassembled and give a glimpse of the iconography used. More clues to the culture are in the gold objects, such as the now famous small golden jaguar pendant, living right now in a case all to himself.
It was found on the chief's chest, and that's an emerald in his back, and that probably came from Colombia or Ecuador because Panama didn't have emeralds, so it shows that they were into long-distance trade.
He's called a jaguar, but look closely and you'll see the composite imagery used in so many of these pieces.
He's got a jaguar body and legs, but his feet become reptile claws, and he's got these strange things that come out of his mouth. He has the eyes of a reptile. His nose is a nose leaf. And then if you look in the back of him, you see the wheels. They're like cogged wheels on the back of his tail and a funny little dangler.
Curator Jardine says no one's figured out what that little dangler is yet. And so the mysteries and the stories continue of an ancient civilization with a reverence for gold, of the explorations of a still curious contemporary culture, and of the river whose rushing waters connected the two.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. River of Gold opens tomorrow with an afternoon celebration featuring the music and dance of Panama, a lecture by Dr. Pamela Jardine, as well as jewellery-making demonstrations. Emiliano Pardo Tristan will play classical Panamanian guitar with Cynthia Folio on flute. River of Gold at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology runs through December 16th. Throughout the ages, the great playwrights have held a high place in society. Think Shakespeare, Moliere, Ibsen, Miller, and today Tom Stoppard. Our image of the playwright may be of a man or woman slaving selflessly away in their garret, the words wrenched from a brilliant mind and not merely printed but embossed on the page. And when the magnum opus is complete, the playwright wanders back into the world to observe the great actors of the day breathe life into his words and to accept accolades from thousands of adoring fans. The truth is, as usual, far removed from the fantasy image, And what's really involved in writing a play is now examined by WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer as part of our continuing series on what it takes to bring theatre to life.
Looking at the word playwright, it's not unreasonable to think it might literally mean one who writes plays. But the right in playwright, W-R-I-G-H-T, is actually an archaic English term for maker or crafter, as in a wheelwright or a cartwright. So playwright more accurately means one who crafts or builds plays. Now don't worry, there won't be a quiz on that, but this nuance does highlight the notion that being a playwright, a dramatist, is different from many other forms of writing. A playwright does not just put words on a piece of paper or a computer screen, but he or she crafts a blueprint that's used to build an entire theatrical world that comes to life before a live audience. Seth Rosen, who is both a playwright and artistic director of the Interact Theater Company in Philadelphia, says there is no science, however, to creating a good play.
Great playwrights write bad plays all the time, and there is no formula. So we toil, all of us playwrights, to try to find the combination of structure, style, form, language, characters, story, arcs, etc., to put together something that really works, and also to try to be original in some way.
Different playwrights stumble into writing for theater in a variety of ways. As a director, Seth Rosen found he had a knack for it mid-career while helping other writers develop their plays. Bruce Graham, on the other hand, a nationally produced playwright and screenwriter, discovered a penchant for observing dialogue and writing comedy sketches at a young age.
I was always fascinated with the way people spoke, and I was always eavesdropping on people, adults when I was a little kid, just to learn how people speak and they interrupt each other and they have incomplete thoughts.
Wherever the spark to become a playwright originates, passion for this sort of writing is sustained by a love for the stage for dramatists like Philadelphia-based Arden Cass, who says in contrast to film and television, which is more lucrative, theater is more intimate and organic.
There's something about the chemistry when an actor starts to speak the things you've heard in your mind and adds that richness of their own humanity to it. There's just nothing like that.
Someone wrote, "No longer at this address, return to sender."
So I never got it. Not my fault. I moved around a lot.
Check out return to sender, Dex. Your handwriting, I believe. Return to sender.
Look, no excuse.
Featuring Jennifer Childs and John Lumia, Dex and Julie Sitting in a Tree is one of Bruce Graham's latest plays. It premiered at the Arden Theater in Philadelphia in early 2007 and was inspired by Graham's visit to his alma mater some time ago while receiving an award. Personal experiences are commonly the springboard of a Graham play, but he says they're certainly not the only entry point when writing a new work.
Some of my plays, I just say, I have great characters. Now I have to find a story. Other times I'll say, I've got a story. Now I have to fill it with the people. Sometimes I say, I got to get this off my chest. You know, I get something, you know, I got to get out. And sometimes those are the better plays, actually.
One mark of a good playwright is that he or she can imagine a story beyond the scope of personal experience. A writer doesn't have to commit a crime to create a compelling drama about prison. Still, Arden Cass insists that playwrights can't entirely keep themselves out of a story.
I don't think there's a playwright out there who, no matter what they tell you, that's not writing from some autobiographical place, because it's coming from your soul. You are all of those characters in some way or another. Even when you think it's somebody that you've made up, it's still a part of you somehow, and you're talking for that person or feeling them talk.
Autobiographical or not, having an idea about a dramatic moment or story and then translating that to the page can be an arduous process. Most playwrights don't just sit down and write a play. There's a lot of preliminary thinking and outlining. Michael Hollinger, whose 2006 show Opus was recently produced off-Broadway, says laying out early ideas for a developing piece tends to involve a lot of scribbles and notes.
Just to kind of blurt out initial broad strokes, as a visual artist might quickly sketch in a kind of general shape of things.
As the play becomes more fleshed out, Hollinger says there are numerous stages of completion within the writing process.
The play is completed to one degree when I type the words in and I get to the end, you know, and I can print it out and bang it on a table and it makes a noise. That's one level of realization. A second level of realization is when I get to sit in a room and hear some actors read it. And at each of those stages, I learn something about the play. I hear it anew. I experience it now, not as something that I read, but it's aural, until finally we get to a full production where all of the elements are in place and we can say, ah, that's what the thing was. That's what the blueprint was designing all along.
More and more, learning the craft of drafting the blueprint of a play happens in the academic setting. Thomas Gibbons, playwright in residence at the Interact Theater, says in recent decades there's been a proliferation of MFA writing programs across the country, which he says in some ways presents a danger.
There's a certain sameness of sensibility that I see in a lot of the younger playwrights' work, and I'm probably being wildly simplistic. Maybe I'm jealous, I'm not sure. But I'm not entirely convinced that playwriting can be taught, for one thing, or that it's a good idea to study it formally. I think there's a lot to be said for using the world as your classroom and just learning by doing.
Because most playwrights can't write for theater full-time, it's not a job that pays well unless you're at the top of the game. Gaining hands-on training can be hard to come by, especially to get produced. But just as there's no exact science to building a good play, there's also no surefire formula to becoming a well-regarded playwright. Perhaps the common denominator is a little luck, or as a well-regarded English playwright put it, one William Shakespeare, fortune brings in some boats that are not steered.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer, and that feature was produced with help from a grant from the Pennsylvania Council on the Humanities. And that's our program. Our thanks this week to Pam Costi, Catherine Blodgett, and Charles Gagnon. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.